president of Taiwan did not want to be upstaged by the mayor of Taipei, his political rival.
By the time I was 10, I guess I had seen just a huge catalog of MGM Warner Brothers films. It was no wonder why eventually I was flunking out of school. I was so exhausted.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Britain's third party becomes first in support for marriage rights, Taiwan's president holds historic huddle with gays and lesbians, and muscle boys meet teen slasher for a psycho beach party at the movies. All that and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Cindy Friedman.
And I'm Jake Schulte.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending September 23rd, 2000. Britain's third party, the Liberal Democrats, this week voted overwhelmingly to make creation of civil partnerships for gay and lesbian couples a plank in the party's election platform. The move on the first day of the party's annual convention made the Lib Dems the first mainstream party in the UK to endorse legal recognition of same-gender couples. The proposal by failed London mayoral candidate Susan Cramer would allow registration for any unmarried couple in England and Wales if both parties were at least 16 years old. Although Cramer insisted the partnerships would not be gay marriage, they would confer many of the legal benefits of marriage, including property, inheritance, immigration, taxation, adoption, and fostering rights. Cramer called it an issue whose time is overdue.
In a U.S. primary election this week, open gay Jim R. Morrison, just 21 years old, won the Democratic nomination for a seat in the Washington State House of Representatives. His father, Jim L. Morrison, was a candidate for the same seat, but lost his bid for the Republican nomination. Incumbent Republican Representative Mary Skinner, having beaten the father in the primary, will now face the son in November. Also, the Oakland, California City Council this week voted in Taiwan-born attorney Danny Wan to fill a vacant seat, making him the San Francisco area city's first openly gay council member.
Arizona Republican State Representative Steve May was recommended this week for an honorable discharge from the U.S. Army Reserves because he is openly gay. The Army referred in particular to Lieutenant May's first-person advocacy for domestic partnership benefits in a State House floor debate last year as a violation of the so-called Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy. May's attorney Christopher Wolf argued that what May said in the legislature is protected by the Speech and Debate Clause of the U.S. Constitution. May intends to appeal all the way up the military chain of command and then file a federal lawsuit if necessary.
The new leader of Canada's Alliance Party, Stockwell Day, was sworn in as a member of parliament this week. Almost all the members of parliament welcomed him with a hearty standing ovation, and many shook his hand as he walked down the center aisle for the very first time. But a few members of the New Democratic Party declined to cheer his arrival, and openly gay NDP member Sven Robinson refused to shake Day's outstretched hand. Robinson later told reporters, "Why would I join in welcoming a man to the House of Commons who stands for everything that I fought against for my entire political career? I'm not going to applaud on my feet vigorously at the arrival of a leader in the House of Commons who is profoundly opposed to equality, who has said that gay and lesbian people are second-class citizens, that there should be no human rights protection, and that AIDS is a sign of the depravity that God is punishing. No way. I'm not talking about Stockwell Day's personal religious beliefs. That's not the issue. I'm talking about Stockwell Day's public political record." Day, whose charisma has been steadily cutting into the ruling Liberal Party's lead in the polls, wasn't bothered. He told reporters, "I am certainly open to shaking his hand at any time and working with him on issues related to improving legislation in this country. And if he's refusing to shake my hand because I happen to be pro-life and because I happen to support the federal Liberal government definition of marriage in the tax law, then I guess he's refusing to shake the hands of millions of Canadians. That's regrettable for somebody who claims to represent all the people."
Canada's Immigration Minister Eleanor Caplan has put forward a bill to make HIV and hepatitis B tests mandatory for all prospective immigrants and to exclude from the country those who are HIV positive or chronic carriers of hepatitis B. Both of those viruses disproportionately affect gay men. Currently, Canada tests prospective immigrants for tuberculosis and syphilis with HIV testing at the physician's discretion. But while people with TB and syphilis can be treated and cured and allowed to immigrate, those with HIV would be permanently medically inadmissible. Canada is one of the world's leaders in receiving immigrants and refugees, and Caplan's health consultants estimated that some 200 people with HIV are accepted into the country each year. They further projected that immigrants unknowingly pass on HIV to about 37 Canadians each year and called Caplan's proposal the best public health option. But other medical experts and activists immediately objected that there is no public health justification for mandatory HIV testing of immigrants any more than there is for mandatory testing of current citizens, because the virus is not transmitted through casual contact and people can protect themselves from infection. One public health expert noted that there's no screening for risks of developing heart disease, which is actually more costly to treat than AIDS. Opponents maintained that the HIV ban would be discriminatory, particularly against non-whites from some of the world's poorest nations. At least one group is recommending that instead of a blanket ban on immigration by people with HIV, Canada should follow the Australian model of considering HIV status as just one factor in assessing the contributions an individual can make to the nation. Caplan said there would be further discussion of her proposal in the provinces.
Rock star Melissa Etheridge and her partner of more than a decade, filmmaker Julie Cypher, issued a statement this week saying, "With the utmost of love and respect for one another, we have decided to separate. As committed parents, our top priority continues to be what is in the best interests of our children. Though elements of our lives will change, our family will always remain intact." The couple has two children, 3-year-old Bailey and 21-month-old Beckett, who were birthed by Cypher with sperm donated by musician David Crosby. The couple and their representatives have refused any further comment on the matter. However, their friend, actress Kathy Najimy, told reporters that the women were moving into houses with adjacent backyards so the children could easily visit back and forth, and hinted that the separation might not be permanent.
But John Polk's visit to a Washington, D.C. gay bar may well have a permanent impact on his career as a poster boy and leader of the ex-gay movement. Polk was spotted by one staff member of the Human Rights Campaign who called another who came over armed with a camera. Polk's story is that he came in search of a bathroom without knowing it was a gay bar until he was inside. He said he stayed and had a glass of water and chatted with some patrons out of curiosity to see if anything had changed in the 15 years since he'd last been in a gay bar. He said later that it was poor judgment and he should have left immediately. The HRC staffers insist there were many more appealing venues on the same block that anyone looking for a bathroom would have chosen instead. They say that Polk stayed for 40 minutes and even offered to buy one of them a drink, leaving only when the others started taking photos of him. Polk said later that he still had the support of his wife, self-identified ex-lesbian Anne, and of his employer, the religious right media empire Focus on the Family. But he may well lose his post as North American board chair of Exodus International, the coalition of about 100 groups claiming to change gays and lesbians into heterosexuals. Other board members conferred by phone after the story broke and will make a decision within 2 weeks.
It was a night of terror at a gay bar in Roanoke, Virginia this week. A man bought a beer at the Backstreet Cafe and then pulled a handgun from his pocket and opened fire. Of about 25 people in the bar, he wounded 6 and killed 1, Danny Overstreet. Police have charged 53-year-old Ronald Edward Gay with the murder and are considering the attack a hate crime. They say that earlier in the evening, Gay told people at another bar that he wanted to shoot some gay people and asked where the gay bar was. One person gave him directions and then called police.
Anti-gay top-rated U.S. radio talk show host Dr. Laura Schlesinger's new syndicated TV show is stopping production for a week, just 2 weeks after its on-air debut. Producer and syndicator Paramount insists the break has been planned all along, but many in the industry find it surprising. Various spokespeople have said the time is for planning, making adjustments, and retooling the show. Critics have uniformly panned it. The show has done so badly in the ratings that ad sales have had to be discounted, and at the urging of activists, more than 45 companies have demanded that their ads not be run during the program.
And finally, Camilla Andersen of Denmark and Mia Hundvin of Norway registered their partnership in Denmark earlier this year, but this week they were opponents at the Olympics. Andersen is a major star of Denmark's defending Olympic champion handball team, while Hundvin's Norwegian handball team is ranked number one in the world. A preliminary match this week was an exciting seesaw battle that ultimately went to Norway by 19-17, with Andersen disappointing her fans by scoring on only about 20% of her attempts. Previously, a Danish Olympic official had remarked that, "I don't object to the marriage or to them fraternizing before the match, as long as they are fiercely competitive during it." Hundvin said of her partnership, "When we talk, it's definitely not about handball. That's too boring."
That's News Wrap for the week ending September 23rd, 2000. Follow the news in your area. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap is written by Cindy Friedman and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles. For This Way Out, I'm Chase Schulte.
And I'm Cindy Friedman.
Off-Broadway's very offbeat drag diva is slashing her way to the silver screen with a cult hit that some are calling the most off-the-wall comedy of the year. We'll hang 10 at our own private psycho beach party with Charles Bush later in the program. A first-of-its-kind Pride Festival was held in early September in Taiwan, and American writer Michael Bronski and legal activist Nan Hunter were invited to participate in the festivities, held in and funded in part by the city of Taipei. I talked last week with Nan Hunter about the various events at the two-day festival.
It was an opportunity to see the beginning stages of a lesbian and gay rights movement in a very different culture.
And in this week's conclusion, Hunter discusses the role of religion in Taiwan politics and speculates on the long-term impact of the Pride Festival there. We begin with the unexpected but crowning event of the festival.
You just never know in the world of lesbian and gay rights what's going to happen next. I mean, it just seems like the unpredictable happens all the time. In doing the planning for this event, the people in Taiwan had not made any contact with the president of the country. It was sponsored, as I said, by the city government of Taipei. But as it turns out, the mayor of Taipei, who is a very dynamic, young, progressive, sort of Kennedy-esque type politician, is the leader of one political party in Taiwan, and the president of the country is his major political rival. He's the leader of the other large political party there. And apparently, as nearly as I was able to tell, the president of Taiwan did not want to be upstaged by the mayor of Taipei, his political rival. So although homosexuality is a very controversial and, you know, very kind of delicate issue there, certainly, if anything, even more so than here, the president of Taiwan had his staff contact the organizers of the event and request that they set up a meeting with him, the president, between him and the speakers at the forum, because he wanted to show that he was just as strong in support of human rights and democracy and so forth as the mayor of Taipei. So to the amazement of the people who were organizing the event, who had not sought this out in any way, it just sort of came in, and certainly to my and Michael's amazement, we found ourselves scheduled to meet the president of the country, which we did the day after the forum. And we were joined by a leading human rights lawyer in Taiwan and two of the leaders of the lesbian and gay rights organization. So the five of us went to the National Palace, and we met the president. And it was quite an event. It was the president, of course, it was very formal, and it was, you know, kind of very ceremonial and so forth. The president was very gracious. Michael and I took him two gifts. We presented him with a rainbow flag, which we unfurled and, you know, had these photos taken of the five of us plus the president standing behind a rainbow flag. And my own favorite moment for me personally was that I took him as a gift a rainbow lapel pin, which I then had to pin on the president of Taiwan, which I managed to do without stabbing him, or at least injuring him too badly. He was quite good-humored about the whole thing. So we presented him with these gifts, and we had these ceremonial photographs taken and so forth. And so Michael and I returned to the U.S. having met the president of the country.
That's really a wonderful story. I'm talking with Nan Hunter, a U.S. GLBT and HIV legal activist who was among those participating in Taiwan's first ever Pride Festival in the capital city of Taipei. Now, Nan, I read where some conservative Christian groups had taken out a newspaper ad protesting the Pride events, and particularly the government's participation. But it's also my understanding that religion plays a much smaller role in politics there, certainly less than in most Western countries.
That seems to be the case. I mean, there was a protest, a press conference by some of the Christian groups just prior to our arrival, and I guess the day before the festival. And in fact, the Taiwanese leaders of these organizations, I think, wondered whether, as a result of that, there would be some stepping back from a public appearance by either the mayor of Taipei or the president of Taiwan, if they would be sort of deterred from doing that. But in fact, they were not. And it does seem to me that the religions which are the strongest there, which are not Christianity, but there doesn't seem to be that kind of specifically religious voice or argument against homosexuality. That does not seem to factor in very much.
And the obvious final question, Nan, what kind of lasting impact do you think this first ever Pride Festival is going to have on the fledgling GLBT equality movement in Taiwan?
Well, with all of with all events like this, I mean, there are these sort of small but incremental impacts. One of the things that I said to the president in our, sort of moments, we each had a few minutes to speak, and one of the things that I said in my time to speak was that I thought that the most historic aspect of the meeting, which I was very honored to be a part of, was that it was the first time that a head of state of Taiwan had met with leaders of Taiwanese lesbian and gay organizations. And that although Michael and I would be soon getting on planes and leaving Taiwan, that I hoped it would be the first of many meetings between his administration, which is a new administration. He was just inaugurated about 6 months ago, and the Taiwanese lesbian and gay rights groups. One of the things that's so interesting about the Taiwanese situation is that the people who are now in positions of power, the president, the woman who's the vice president, and so forth, were leaders of the opposition to martial law. So that the president of the country, for example, once spent a month in jail, in prison, as a political prisoner. The vice president spent time in prison as a political prisoner. So they have a very real sense of the importance of democracy and human rights. And I'm hopeful that what we were able to do in our time there was to bring some attention to the similarity between the concerns for human rights and individual freedom that that they felt when they were fighting against martial law, and the kinds of issues that the lesbian and gay Taiwanese groups and leaders feel now. So I'm hoping that the people who are there will really be able to build on it. I mean, one of the specific things that did come out of these events is that the mayor of Taipei reaffirmed his commitment to continuing to have and to sponsor city programs, so that he, in his speech to the forum, he said that he intended to have his government sponsor a forum and a festival again next year. This was the first one this year, and he said he wanted it to be a continuing thing. So that was a very important statement, and that was the statement that got most of the news coverage. So hopefully it will be a significant part of trying to open up some space there for people to feel safe about coming out.
That was Nan Hunter, legal activist in GLBT and HIV-related issues and a professor at Brooklyn Law School, discussing her participation in the first ever Gay Pride Festival in Taipei, Taiwan.
Hi, this is Ron Romanofsky.
And this is Paul Phillips.
And we're Romanofsky
and Phillips.
You're listening to This Way Out,
the international gay and lesbian radio magazine.
And if we weren't on the radio right now, I'm sure we would be listening.
Charles Bush is the playwright and cross-dressing star of such off-Broadway classics as Vampire Lesbians of Sodom, Red Scare on Sunset, and Theodora, She-Bitch of Byzantium. In his dubious spare time, this celebrated lady of the theater also authored the novel Whores of Lost Atlantis. Bush appeared in the film Adam's Family Values and has a recurring role on the popular HBO prison drama series Oz. But now, one of his earliest works, Psycho Beach Party, has hit the big screen. This Way Out's Steve Pride got to meet the gay cult icon and find out more about his beach blanket bloodbath.
It's Malibu, California, 1962. We're hanging ten with hip cats and groovy chicks. The sun is bright, the waves are high, and the killer is turning our cool scene into one psycho beach party. But no fear, Daddy-O. Detective Monica Stark is on the case.
Fellas, do, please, sit down. I want to talk to you about the murders that have been taking place. I'm concerned that one of you could be the killer's next target.
Why us?
Well, so far, the killer's gone after a girl with a hair lip, a young lady in a wheelchair, a boy with psoriasis, and another with one testicle. Is there anything about you that the killer could possibly perceive as freakish? Come now, fess up. Everyone has something they'd rather hide.
Hello, I'm Charles Bush. I first came up with the notion of this play, Psycho Beach Party, I guess in around 1986. I had a little theater company in New York at the time. We called ourselves Theater in Limbo because we performed in a place called the Limbo Lounge way down into the depths of the East Village. After each performance, I would do a curtain speech to get people to sign our mailing list, and I would try to make it into something of a comedy routine. One thing I did was I would just invent on the spot titles of future plays we might do, and one night I said, and we'll do Gidget Goes Psychotic. And I got a very nice laugh, so I kept that as kind of my punchline for a long time. And eventually we thought, we've been publicizing this show. We ought to do one called Gidget Goes Psychotic. And eventually, I wrote it, we did it, and we later called it Psycho Beach Party. And it ran in New York for about 10 months. And it's been done, thank God, all over just about every state of the United States and Berlin.
Was Charles Bush born a genius, or is all this the product of permissive parenting?
I am totally the product of a completely permissive childhood. But, my family was so traumatized early on. My mother died when I was 7, and my father is a bit of a free spirit, not the most responsible person, but a lot of fun. He loves old movies. So when I was growing up, I just would watch The Late Show with him, and by the time I was 10, I guess I had seen, just a huge catalog of MGM Warner Brothers films. There was no wonder why eventually I was flunking out of school. I was so exhausted.
While in the film version of Psycho Beach Party, Charles Bush plays a fantabulous flatfoot. In the original play, he created the role of the mentally unbalanced ingenue, Chiclet.
Tell you the truth, it was never really one of my favorite parts of the play. And in fact, the character has split personalities. And one reason I did that, actually, was because I didn't really want to just play this sort of young teenage girl. And I thought if her alter ego was more of a femme fatale, it would be more in keeping with my comic persona. So I was never that sentimental about it. And when the producers of the movie wanted to make it, there was really no question that I kind of always thought it would be a real girl. A film is just more naturalistic to start. You're on real locations on a real beach, and it seemed like it was a bit of a stretch having me at this point in my life, even if I'm the wrong gender, to play this young teenage girl. It really takes it to a highly stylized place. Instead, since I'm also the screenwriter, I wrote myself a fabulous new part, which wasn't in the original play. The movie is more of a thriller, kind of a little bit like a 70s slasher movie at times. So if you have a killer, you need a sleuth. So I wrote the new part of Captain Monica Stark, LAPD. And I'm kind of the detective who's a bit of a cross between Joan Crawford and Susan Hayward, I'd say.
What? Having second thoughts?
It's just that, well, I'm taking the detective's exam next month.
Shouldn't you be thinking about having babies?
A baby? You've got to be kidding. My career's just building. I'm going to show those bastards that a woman couldn't be a detective.
And where do I fit in?
Honey, bitch is fine.
Stop it! I'm not your whore.
Don't talk that way.
This isn't what I want. None of it.
Come back! Darling, all the success in the world means nothing unless you're beside me. I need you!
Of course, behind every leading lady, there's a dreamboat called her leading man.
I was thrilled when they told me that Thomas Gibson was interested in the part. I was thrilled because, you know, Thomas Gibson's, I think he's a wonderful actor, and it's tricky material to play. You know, it's a parody. At the same time, it requires a certain amount of sincerity. It's the rather original style, and then to do it on film makes it even more difficult. I thought we really needed experienced actors. And in the movie, on Psycho Beach Party, I have this sex scene with Thomas Gibson, and I was so looking forward to it. But when we shot the scene, after just when the going was going good, I stepped out and I had a body double, because it's sort of amusing where suddenly you see this woman's breasts. So I stepped out, and then actually what happened then is that Thomas Gibson had to leave by midnight, and so he left, and the director's lover happened to be just watching, and next thing you know, he had Thomas Gibson's costume on, and he was lying there with this nude woman right in his face. Here my big sex scene, and neither of us were there.
Doris Day said, whatever will be, but what does Charles Bush think the future holds?
I'm having a very exciting year to get back to my great career, because not only is Psycho Beach Party opening as a movie, but I have a new play opening on Broadway at Ethel Barrymore Theater in October, which is so thrilling because I've actually, you know, I'm sort of the queen of off-Broadway, but never on Broadway. So I have a new play, The Tale of the Allergist Wife, that I'm not in, that we have a wonderful cast, Linda Lavin and Michelle Lee and Tony Roberts. So this will be the first of my plays on Broadway, but I've paid my dues, baby.
This has been Steve Pride with Charles Bush, a hip chick and a groovy guy. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for tuning into This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine. This week, Cindy Friedman, Chase Schulte, Graham Underhill, Chris Ambidge, Jason Lynn, Ryan Nunes, Rex Walkner, Mark R. Carr, and Steve Pride contributed program material. Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. Some This Way Out operating expenses are funded by grants from the Gill Foundation and the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation by Planet Out, from designated contributions by Uncommon Cloud Visa cardholders who've chosen This Way Out, and through direct charitable donations from our listeners around the world. For audio cassette information or with any questions or comments about This Way Out, please email us at tworadio@aol.com. Visit our webpage at thiswayout.org or write to us at Post Office Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. And please be sure to include the call letters of this station. Remember, you can also hear This Way Out anytime online, exclusively on Planet Out. Just point your browser to www.planetout.com and click first on Multimedia, then on Radio. For Lucia Chappell and the entire This Way Out family, I'm Greg Gordon. We all thank you for listening on WORT Madison, Wisconsin, KSUA Fairbanks, Alaska, Dade City Community Radio, Dade City, Florida, and more than 100 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Please stay tuned.